Hi, everyone. Welcome to OA's 60th birthday party weekend. My name is Susan. I'm a compulsive overeater. Okay, so Big Book Workshop, just a few things for you to know. There are restrooms across the hallway. We have free tea and coffee, which is over in the reception area where there are more bathrooms. If you leave the room, try not to slam the doors. They're very heavy. It's just a little bit disturbing. This is being recorded, so if you can't stay for all of it, you will be able to buy the recording at the end of the weekend. As you can see, we have a new addition. We now have ASL interpreters. So if you know anyone who, there you go. Anybody who doesn't come to our fellowship because they're not understanding what's going on, from now on they will. These ladies will be here all weekend. As of now, they're shadowing one person, but if there are others who you know, they will work it out. And they're also going to leave their whereabouts up front with registration. So again, if you know anyone who hasn't been, they can now come. Yes. Oh, okay. Yes, I will. Is that better? Then it might be the actual volume. Okay, well, I'm going to be being quiet in a few minutes. Anyway, so bathrooms across the hall, drinks, prize drawing, very important. We might draw a grand prize tonight. So if you want to buy any tickets, make sure that you clearly write your name and number on the back of them, because if we can't read it, it's going to have to go back in and it will become somebody else's gift. We're also going to do another prize drawing or two at lunchtime tomorrow. Okay, so without more rambling on from me, I want to introduce you to the fabulous Kim G, who's here all the way from New Jersey. And you're going to get many, many words of wisdom about the Big Book. Kim's been in these rooms since 1994, and now she's going to share with you her journey. So enjoy.
Hi, everyone. Hi, my name is Kim G, and I am a recovered compulsive overeater from the South Jersey area. I thought I'd tell you a little bit about my history in OA first. Like Susan said, I came into OA in 1994. The first meeting I ever went to, actually, my mom's been in OA. My mom came into OA when I was 10 years old. So when I was at a point where I was desperate, I did come into OA. Now, I did not come into OA at my top weight. My top weight was a size 24 at around the age 23. I went to the doctor, and he diagnosed me as morbidly obese. And the most natural thing to do was, like, you think this is obese? I'll show you obese. And I continued to eat. And I was taught bulimia in college. So I said, I'm going to do something about this. And I started practicing bulimia, was not very good at throwing up, started to lean more heavily on exercise bulimia, and got down to a size 14. Now, I don't know, on the East Coast, there was a bunch of stores called 16 plus in the 80s. And I just thought, if I can get below a 16, I'm going to be okay. So I got down to a size 14, and I was absolutely gobsmacked to realize I'm just as insane at a size 14 as I was at a size 24. In fact, I was more terrified, not understanding at the time, but now I am in the ism of my alcoholism without a solution of food. And that's actually when I came into OA. But I've also, in OA, dieted down to a size 2, where my hair was starting to fall out, my period had stopped, because I didn't know how not to diet. So the reason I like to say that is that it didn't matter whether I was a size 24, whether I was a size 14, or whether I was a size 2. The mind hadn't changed, and therefore I continued to suffer from compulsive overeating. And my first meeting that I went to, the woman who was speaking was an incest survivor, and the two other newcomers also suffered from sexual abuse. I don't have that in my history. And I didn't return to a meeting for 6 months because I thought sexual abuse was a prerequisite for being in OA, because I didn't hear anything about compulsive overeating or about the steps or about my problem. It was all about sexual abuse. But the food beat me into, again and again, that I came back after 6 months. The first year that I was in OA, I just basically tried to control and enjoy my eating. There was a meeting at a local mall, and it was Tuesdays and Thursdays. And I would think, okay, they're going to be my pizza nights, because I'll have my two slices of pizza and I'll go to the meeting, and that will give me the strength to not binge that night. Sometimes that worked, sometimes it didn't. And then in 1996, I heard about these two guys from Arkansas who were in AA that were doing a convention in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. I did not know it at the time, but I got to see Joe and Charlie, who everyone here probably has heard of. And it was an amazing, amazing weekend. But I walked out of that weekend thinking, man, that's great information. But thank goodness I'm just a compulsive overeater and I just have to do my food plan and go to meetings. So I joined Hal. I know there's a Hal out here. I know Hal's different across the country. But in my area, Hal was basically a food plan and tools. And for 6 years, I had white-knuckled abstinence, only working the tools. It was slogan-driven, but it was a lot better than being in relapse, but I wasn't free. And after 6 years of back-to-back abstinence, I was doing the, you know, service like a crazy person. You know, service makes you, you know, the service is slimming. And I did that all the time. I was the intergroup chair for South Jersey. I went on, I was on the region board for Region 7, and they wanted me to run for World Service Trustee. And I was terrified. I didn't want to do that. And since I hadn't done any steps, I don't know how to say no. So my keen alcoholic mind told me, well, if I pick up, I'm not qualified. I don't have to say them no because I'm not qualified, and I'll just get back on track tomorrow. And after that 6 years and then picking up, I never got more than 8 or 9 months. And then I started not to get any more than 8 or 9 weeks. And then I started not get any more than 8 or 9 days. And then I was in the middle of a 5-year relapse in 2011. And I had broken my ankle. I have a little Jack Russell who took me out. And I looked down and my foot was facing 180 degrees the wrong way. And I was in bed, and I was in relapse, and my mom's in OA, and I'm having her buy my binge foods since I'm bed bound. And I got a phone call from one of my mentors in South Jersey Intergroup, and she was so excited because she saw I had an article in Lifeline magazine. And I said, what are you talking about? And here, another girl named Kim G from my hometown of Mount Laurel, New Jersey, where I grew up, had written an article. And I said, Penny, that's not me. I've been in relapse for like 5 years now. And she's like, oh, my God, what's going on? And I started to cry, and I told her. And she told me about a phone meeting that studied the big book. Now, I'm in South Jersey. We had like 35, 40 meetings there. I thought people who did phone meetings were ridiculous. But I'm screwed. I have to do something. So I call up this phone meeting. And I never, you know... In my area, I don't know how it is in your area, but my area is very popular to, in the beginning of the meeting, say, my name is so-and-so, or are there any other compulsive overeaters here besides myself? And we would all raise our hands. And what I learned from studying this big book is that for 17 years, I had raised my hand saying, I'm fat and I don't want to be fat anymore, or I'm no longer fat and I'm terrified of getting fat again. I had no idea what it meant to be a compulsive overeater. And through this phone meeting, they started to educate me on this twofold nature of the illness, that I have this allergy to the body and I have this mental twist. And I was desperate because in New Jersey, we get 12 weeks of short-term disability. So I knew I was on this limited time period that if I didn't do this work now, I wasn't going to do it once I went back to work. And I was calling people and nobody could sponsor me. So what I did is I took this phone meeting. And I would listen to the paragraph. I'd listen to a couple shares. I'm sure a lot of you probably listen to Vision for You. Any of you guys fast forward to the people you like? Well, that's what I did. And there's a gentleman that was on that meeting, and he always shared last. So I knew to fast forward to him, and we would get to the next paragraph. So I was listening to 4 meetings an hour almost, doing this, calling people, asking questions. And then the woman, Penny, who called me, I said, is there any way you can take my fifth step for me over the phone? I said, because I can't get out of the house. And she said, sure. And by that time, I had enough relationships with people that when I got to my 9th step, I could call them and ask for advice. I would be able to go through there. And then I started to sponsor. So in a 6-week period, I went through all 12 steps without a sponsor, not alone, with people. And I recovered. And I realized that for 17 years, I had periods of relief, but I had never had freedom. And in 6 weeks, I had freedom. And I can't tell you, I don't even know my abstinence date. I use October 31st because I do a algebra problem from when I broke my ankle to when I think sometime in that 3-week period, I put down the food. But that just tells you the power of this. We don't need to suffer anymore, and we don't need it to be that long. So what I decided to do is, actually, I want to tell you one more thing. The word recovered, I know when I first heard that in big book meetings, I thought those people were the most arrogant people in the world. That I'm recovering, you're saying you're cured, blah, blah, blah. That's not what recovered means. The way that I personalize that is recovering is me, you know, hustling for recovery, me doing the steps, me doing the tools, me going to meetings, me doing me. It was all selfish. Recovered is the most selfless thing I say today, because recovered means to me that God is dealing for me what I have been incapable to do myself. So I'm giving God the credit for something that I couldn't do as much as I tried and I tried and I tried in these rooms with the best of intentions to try to stop eating. So I talked about this ankle injury, and I just wanted to kind of tell you, it kind of like paralleled my own recovery. So like I said, I was in a snowstorm, and my little Jack Russell went zigged, and I zagged, and I looked down. I had my foot was 180 degrees the wrong way. And when I went to the doctor, and he said to me that I have this two-fold injury. One is the outside bone on the outside of the leg. I'm not in medical, so it's tibia, fibia, whatever one's on the outside. It snapped in half, and I ripped every muscle and tendon in my ankle. And he said to me there was a pretty good chance I wasn't going to be able to walk again, and that my injury was going to depend on the greater aspect of my injury was my muscles and tendons. That's what's going to determine whether I could walk again. But this bone that was snapped in half, I was going to have surgery the next day. And I had plates and screws put in my ankle. And the reason I like that is because we have this twofold nature of our illness, right? We have this allergy of the body, which means when I put certain substances in my body, I cannot reasonably predict what's going to happen. Maybe I don't binge every time, but I cannot guarantee you what's going to happen when I put certain substances in my body. But the larger aspect of my disease is this mental twist. And that's why we need a 12-step program. The mental twist is treated through the 12 steps. The doctor also told me it would take me 1 year to recover from this injury, and that would determine whether I walked again. But after 30 days, I went back to the doctor and said, well, why aren't I better? He said, Kim, I told you it's going to take 12 months. Okay. And I would go back to him another 30 days and say, well, why aren't I better? And he would go, I told you it's going to take 12 months. So isn't that true with our own disease? You know, we're told there's 12 steps, but after 12, what we do step one, we put the food down. Why aren't I better? How many of us have done the OA waltz? Steps 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. And my waltz always ends in relapse. Why? Because it's 12 steps I have to do. This is not a 3-step program. The other thing is I had to go to physical therapy 3 days a week. And I saw the same people in physical therapy. And at one point I said to my physical therapist, I said, I'm a little confused. I see the same people, yet it seems some people seem to be getting better and other people aren't getting better. And he kind of laughed and looked at me and he said, Kim, it's pretty obvious to us that you're doing your homework between your visits. And it's also pretty obvious to us that other people are not. So that's the truth here. I have really bad news for y'all. Meetings do not treat compulsive overeating. Meetings expose you to the solution to compulsive overeating, which are the steps. But your recovery is not going to be based on the meetings that you attend, but the work you do in between. Your recovery is not going to depend on who your sponsor is and the phone calls you have with your sponsor, but what is the work you do between those phone calls? And that's why I recovered from my ankle injury. I also had to have acceptance about certain things. I had to give away all my heels because I can't wear heels anymore. You know, and there's certain, I do yoga, and if I don't do my yoga consistently, my ankle starts to bother me. If we do not, you know, I have a permanent injury there. You know, this, once again, if you look at me and you see me walking around, you would never know I had an ankle injury. I've recovered from that injury because I am asymptomatic. But I am not cured. Once again, if I don't do my yoga, when I fly, my ankle kind of swells and I don't have feeling in my outside of my foot, and my foot tends to swell when I fly. So I have to be conscious of that. I'm recovered from compulsive overeating. I am asymptomatic. I do not suffer from compulsive overeating. But I am under no delusion that I am cured of compulsive overeating. And I just a side thing, I have bone loss. I'm of that age. And I had to have IV infusion therapy this fall. And I had every freaking side effect. But one of the side effects was I got to relive the year and a half of my injury because all the calcium went straight to my injury. And I couldn't walk for like a week. And it was so painful getting up. And I honestly, it just gave me an incredible gratitude to see how lucky I am that I can walk on my ankle. And I have to tell you, every time I take on someone else through this big book, it's the same exact thing. When I help someone walk through the 12 steps, I get a front row seat to see what my life would be like if I wasn't doing this work. So I thought one way for us to kind of get to know each other a little bit is that I'm going to be going over Bill's story as an introduction. You know, I didn't like Bill's story. I mean, my home group, actually, I want to tell you too, my home group is in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. It's Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. in case y'all want to stop by, wherever y'all live. But we also have a podcast, if anyone's interested. If you go on iTunes, it's OA Big Book Cherry Hill NJ for New Jersey. If you don't have iTunes, it's the platform is podbean.com, podbean.com. And that is my home group. I also attend the phone meeting of Vision for You, which is simply a big book study. It's a meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. And the reason I say I participate is because I participate. And the reason I say this is my home group is in Cherry Hill is because that's where my service is. I'm the treasurer there. I get speakers. That's my home group because that's where I put all my my service in. But I also participate in Vision for You almost on a daily basis. So my home group has always been a big book meeting. But what we used to do is we never read the first 164 pages because that was kind of boring. And we always would read the stories, but we read them for like 20 minutes. And then we would disregard what we read and we would talk about how our boss was mean to us and our cat died. And, you know, I call them dead cat meetings. Like that kind of thing. So that what changed when I got into this big book and I was hungry for this, is we little by little were introducing things and we're now a page-by-page big book study. And our meeting has really grown because now instead of trying to just identify in with the stories in the back, we're actually doing the work in the front of the book and people's lives are changing. So this Bill story I always kind of, you know, put aside because, first of all, I'm not a man. You know, I'm not, I don't know about World War II. Yes?
Can you say the address of that podcast?
Sure. If you're on iTunes, you're just going to search your podcast, and it's OA Big Book Cherry Hill NJ. And if you go on, the platform is Podbean, podbean.com. Yeah, B as in boy, Podbean. And then it's the same name. You would just search for OA Big Book, Cherry Hill, NJ. So when I started to learn this story, I was told to approach it two different ways. Forget he's a guy. Forget he's a World War II guy. Forget he's a stockbroker. We want to identify in, do I have the same ism that Bill has in alcoholism that I have in compulsive overeating? So I'm going to ask myself, do I eat like Bill drank? Do I think like Bill thinks? And do I feel like Bill feels? And do I identify also with the progression of the illness? We're going to see Bill go from fun and excitement to necessity to oblivion. So I'm going to talk about Bill, and I'm going to try to tell you my story through Bill's story and see if you all can identify in as compulsive overeaters. So even on page one of Bill's story, it talks about in that first paragraph, here was love, applause, war, moments sublime with intervals hilarious. I was part of life at last, and in the midst of it, I discovered liquor. But by the end of that same paragraph, it says, I was very lonely and again turned to alcohol. So for one of the things from my childhood, I just think of Halloween. Halloween was so much fun as a kid. We used to use pillowcases because we would get so much candy and we go from street to street. And it was this way for us kids to really, really hang out together. But by the time I'm in high school and I'm an adult, I would buy Halloween candy like 6 weeks out to get the good, you know, bargain. But then I'd have to replace it at 5 weeks. And I'd replace it at 4 weeks. And I'd replace it at 3 weeks. And then finally Halloween would come, and I'd hope to God no kid would ring the doorbell so I could have all that candy myself. So what started out as this big social thing became this way of me of isolating myself. And that's exactly what you're seeing with Bill. And for me personally, like, the real holidays were the day after. The best day was November 1st when all the candy was half off. The best day was February 15th when all the Valentine's Day candy was half off. Because that's when I celebrated, because I started to become more and more antisocial. On page 2, we're going to see Bill talk about that first paragraph, how he'd proved to the world that he was important. And he even says potential alcoholic, because he's recognizing that the way his brain worked, even before the alcoholism took him over, that's what made him an alcoholic. So I thought about, what was my brain like? How was I interpreting the world? I remember in kindergarten, nothing to do with food, but in kindergarten, that we had a crossing guard, and a bunch of us kids crossed without the crossing guard, and she caught us, and I ran all the way home so scared, because I always wanted to be the good little girl and not get in trouble. And I was so panicked that this crossing guard would come and talk to my mom and say I did the wrong thing. You know, my freshman year in college, high school, my parents still live in the house I grew up with, so I went through school with all the same kids. So first through eighth grade, I was in a Catholic school, knew all the kids, never learned to make friends because I didn't need to. I've known them since I was six. And I so remember when I went to the Catholic high school, so I went from a grammar school of about 70 kids to a high school that had like 400 to 500 kids. And they had a thing where, you know, a homeroom rep. And nobody, nominated me. Now, in my grammar school, I didn't win a lot of things, but I was always nominated. And I remember that moment that I thought, oh my God, nobody knows who I am. And I instantly became shy in 2 minutes. Because I became so self-conscious at that age. When I played sports, if I wasn't the MVP, I was a total loser. When I was in school, if I got less than 100, I was a total loser. You know, I would get such anxiety. If I always handed in my papers 2 weeks early. Not because I was a goody-goody, but the anxiety of possibly not having that handed in on time would overwhelm me, that I'd have to turn stuff in 2 weeks early. This has nothing to do with food. Living in that head as a 6-year-old and a 16-year-old, that's really, really painful. So what did I find? I found a solution to that anxiety in my head, which was food. And for a few minutes, I would not feel all those things that I was feeling. It talks about on page three, where Bill becomes a success. Because, see, my thing was about popularity. I wanted to be liked. Bill's thing is about money and success. He's driven by that. So it says on page 3 in that first full paragraph, for the next few years, fortune through money and applause my way, I had arrived. My judgment and ideas were followed by many to the tune of paper millions. So this always makes me think of when I, you know, at age 23, I told you I was diagnosed morbidly obese, started to practice bulimia, and exercise bulimia I was really good at it. So I joined a gym, and after I got down to a really thin weight, they asked me if I would write a testimonial to the gym. So I had a before picture and an after picture with a testimonial about how this gym, you know, changed my life. And I remember one day at that gym, leaving that gym and thinking, man, that was a good workout. Maybe I'll just have a slice of pizza. And then next thing you know, I'm going up the scale again. I can no longer go back to that gym, because how can I go back to that gym looking like the before picture again? So I had arrived only to be slammed down again. And Bill talks about that, fair weather friends and becoming the lone wolf. You're going to see this roller coaster that Bill is going to be on, up and down. I definitely can recognize that roller coaster in my own life. You know, it talks about at the bottom of page 3, he got contracted by golf fever. Well, I started out to overtake Walter Hagen, which is like kind of saying, well, you know, I'm going to try golf and I'm going to be Tiger Woods in like 2 weeks. It says, liquor caught up with me much faster than I came up behind Walter. I began to be jittery in the morning. Golf permitted drinking every day and every night. Now, I don't know Bill, but because my mind identifies with Bill, I am guessing that he played golf because it allowed him to drink. You know, I think to myself, I was in a sorority in college and we had a bunch of fundraisers. I always sold the M&Ms, which means I bought the M&Ms because I never sold any. But we sold mugs. I never sold a mug. You know, I have sponsees that get all panicked because they're helping out their kids, like, you know, t-ball team, and they work at the snack bar. I'm like, well, how? I can't not help my child. I'm like, well, is there anything else you can do? Well, there's 50-50 tickets. I'm like, well, why don't you do that? Oh. Because we're putting ourselves in places where food is the center of our attention. And it makes it seem normal. I definitely understand Bill Wilson. And then it talks about the next page where, once again, he crashes with the stock market crash of 1929. It says, the paper reported men jumping to death from the towers of high finance. That disgusted me. I would not jump. I went back to the bar. You know, I think to myself, I go to some sort of a family event with my cousins, and my cousins drank a lot. And I would be so disgusted with their behavior. But yet I'd be sneaking into the kitchen, eating all the leftovers, because it was so stressful being around my family. And my cousins were idiots for drinking, but I was okay with binging my brains out. Same exact thing. Then we see on the top of page 5, one of my favorite lines in his story. The first paragraph, liquor ceased to be a luxury, it became a necessity. Bathtub gin, 2 bottles a day and often 3, got to be routine. Started to think about my own progression. I used to just binge on the weekends. Well, then Friday's really technically a weekend, right? And then when I got to college, I didn't have classes on Friday, so that kind of makes Thursday the weekend, right? And as long as I'm not doing it during the day at work, I guess that's okay too. You know, I started out going to like the high-class bakery shops, but then I'm going to Walmart and buying store-brand Oreos because now I need more to get that same effect that I used to get. I actually didn't realize till I was looking back at my own history that in college I scheduled my classes during mealtimes. Because that way, when I was coming back and everyone else was leaving for class, I could go to the cafeteria, get the food I really wanted, and go to my dorm room and nobody would bother me. Because I couldn't eat the way I wanted or the way I needed to when other people were around. I used to think, like, I need to eat to feel good. I got to the point where it was the only way I could get through the day. It was not about pleasure anymore. It was about staving off whatever emotion that was freaking me out. I used to think that, okay, if I just have one, then it's okay. And that was wonderful when BJ's or Sam's Club opened, because suddenly the one was this huge. So yeah, one bag of Doritos might be enough for a family of 10, but I rationalize it in my head. It's one bag. How can it be that bad? It ceased to be a luxury. It now became a necessity. I love this one too. Then he got a promising business opportunity. Stocks were at the high point in 1932, and I had somehow formed a group to buy. I was to share generously in the profits. Then I went on a prodigious bender, and the chance vanished. I always love that because this happened in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, the exact town that my home group is in. And these guys, now Bill is a brilliant, brilliant man. But not when he's drinking. So they said, listen, Bill, we'll put you in on this deal. You don't even need to put money in. You just have to stay sober and you can help us with this deal. And when the deal started to come to fruition, they wanted to celebrate and they were passing something around called Jersey Lightning. And this is during the Prohibition. So a lot of this stuff is kind of like homemade stuff. And he's like, well, no, he's never had Jersey Lightning. No, 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 I'm not drinking. And finally, I think the second or third time, he said, you know, I really have never had Jersey Lightning. Maybe I'll just have a little bit of Jersey Lightning. And off he went again on a prodigious bender, and he lost out on that opportunity. I so remember after having been, you know, my definition of a success in OA for many years was if I was abstinent more than I was an abstinent that year. So I had a little bit of abstinence behind me, and I was in the grocery store. And they have all the candy when you're walking through. And they made white chocolate peanut butter cups. I thought, how brilliant is that? How could I die without knowing what white chocolate peanut butter cups taste like? I'll just have one. off on another prodigious bender Kim went. Same thing a few years later, walking down the cereal aisle, and they made chocolate chip cookies into a cereal. You dip chocolate chip cookies in milk. How brilliant is that? I need to try this just so I can tell people what it's like. Off on another prodigious bender with Kim. So then we go into page 6. And I love this paragraph because this, to me, is the ism of my alcoholism. This is what my brain is suffering from when I'm eating or not eating. The first full paragraph on page 6. The remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably, and there was a terrible sense of impending calamity. I hardly dared cross the street, lest I collapse and be run down by an early morning truck, for it's scarcely daylight. An all-night place supplied me with a dozen glasses of ale. My writhing nerves were stilled at last. A morning paper told me the market had gone to hell again. Well, so had I. The market would recover, but I wouldn't. That was a hard thought. Should I kill myself? No, not now. This mental fog settled down. Gin would fix that. So two bottles and oblivion. You know, I so remember when I got home from college, and I was not self-supporting by my own contributions. So I moved in with Mommy and Daddy. And I worked in a local town, Marlton, New Jersey. And I would be, you know, not white-knuckling it all day long. And on the way home, I would stop at a grocery store and I would buy a tub of icing. And then I would buy cake mix. I have never made a cake in my entire life. But I thought it would just, the checkout counter girl would understand that I'm making a cake. And I would get in line and I could feel my shoulders relaxing just having the icing in my cart. And then I would get to the register and I'd have to throw M&Ms or something in there because the 5-minute ride home would be too painful unless I had something in my mouth. Impending calamity. What is going to happen? Having to feel like you had to control the entire universe. You know, I also remember, you know, my mom's an OA, so it really kind of sucked when you're active compulsive overeater. So I did a lot of binging in my car. But what I would also do is I would keep muffin mix in my bedroom and a bowl and a spoon. And I would go into the bathroom and put water in a bowl and put the muffin mix there and eat muffin mix like that. I used to say, like, oh, I just like food. How much do I like food if I'm eating muffin mix raw? Because I couldn't cook it. She would smell it. So I'm starting to see how that is the way that I cope with life. You know, I remember that it wasn't that I wanted to binge towards the end. I just needed to get the edge off. You don't understand. If you had my mother, if you had my life, if you had this good thing happen, if you had this bad thing happen, anything that happened felt overwhelming to me. And I just needed to get the edge off. I wasn't going to binge. And then we go to page 7, where Bill is tumbling down, and his brother helps him get into town's hospital, and he meets Dr. Silkworth. And Dr. Silkworth starts to explain to him about this twofold illness. He said, best of all, I met a kind doctor who explained that though certainly selfish and foolish, I had been seriously ill bodily and mentally. It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often seems strong in other respects. My incredible behavior in the face of my desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth on high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. I went to town regularly and even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. You know, and I'm not going to mention it because of an outside book, but there was a book in the 90s that we all had that described the addiction of food addiction beautifully. It was fabulous. We used to pass it around. It was highlighted, underlined, dog-eared. I got it. But I continued to eat. Understanding what my compulsive overeating was not enough. Knowing I had a problem was not enough. And that's what's happening to Bill here. Bill is being given a clear description of what he suffers from, but he doesn't have a solution yet. So if we go to the top of page 8, That first full paragraph, to me, is one of the most beautiful descriptions of step one. It says, "No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in the bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master." And even above that, it talks about he was cornered at last. And I'm a big dog person. And when I'm on Facebook, I guess they know I'm a sucker. They always send me these pages of all these dog rescues and stuff like that. A lot of them are in L.A. too. And they show this mangy dog that's like, he's just mangy and starving and frightened. And they're trying to corner him to help him. And he's fighting with everything he has. He's snarling. He's snapping. He's jumping. And finally, they get the collar on him. And when he finally just surrenders, he goes, "Okay, help me." And that's what happened to me 9 years ago. Okay, help me. Because I have to tell you, when I was introduced to this big book in the beginning, my initial reaction was, I was your effing inner group chair. What were you going to tell me about OA? I've done these steps 100 different ways. This is not going to work for me. And the person challenged me and said, that's really arrogant of you. I'm like, what do you mean? I'm telling you, poor me. I'm laying myself at your feet. And he said, this book has helped alcoholics, drug addicts, compulsive overeaters, sex addicts, gamblers, and you think you're so goddamn special it's not going to work for you? And I was like, yikes. And I have to tell you, I think I did the steps more to spite that person, to show them they were wrong. And even with that attitude, it worked. So when he says here that alcohol was my master, this was something I was starting to see. I had to see that food was my master, drunk or sober. When I'm in the food and I'm going to work, the way I go to work is hit those fast food places and those convenience stores, make it there. When I'm abstinent, white-knuckled, I'm avoiding all those places. I cannot drive past certain places. If I'm in the food, every social event is about who has the best food. I pick my babysitting jobs by their pantries, not by their kids. But when I'm abstinent, I'm avoiding. I will only go to places that people eat exactly like me. People say they love to eat with OA people. I hate eating with OA people. We are a pain in the ass. We are nasty when it comes to that, because we are like, oh, because I thought people were trying to poison me. I was so terrified. That's not peace. So, and I love this idea of quicksand. I'm a big Indiana Jones fan. And I think, I don't know which one it was, but it's the one where Indiana Jones is in the quicksand. He's terrified of snakes. I'm terrified of snakes. And his son is trying to look for something to help pull him out of the quicksand. The only thing that he finds is the end of a python. And he's like, can't you find something else? He's like, no, you're going to die unless you get pulled out of this quicksand. Grab the snake. That is kind of what happens. We get in a place where the last thing we want to do is these steps. The last thing I want to do is put down the food. It's the only solution I've ever had. I didn't mention that, but in the page before, it said gin would fix that. I started to go through this book, and I started to realize that food wasn't my problem. Food was my solution, and unfortunately, my solution started killing me. So I, even in fear and in desperation, I grabbed the end of that snake, which was to humble myself and ask for help after 17 years in OA. And damned if it didn't work. So then in page 8 and 9, so the way that the big book is set up, and I'm just going to do a parallel hill. Bill's story is 16 pages. So we just went through the first 8 pages, and that's all step one. Pages 8 to 12 is step two, and then he's going to go through the rest of the steps in 13, 14, and 15. It's kind of how the big book is set up. The big book is set up that the doctor's opinion, through working with others, is about 115 pages. But the first 4 chapters, doctor's opinion, Bill's story, there's a solution, more about alcoholism, is all step one, and that's like 50-something pages. So literally half the book is on step one. Why? Because if we don't know what we suffer from, who the hell cares about steps 2 through 12? And I'm going to talk about how I'm setting up this weekend, and that's kind of how we're doing this weekend. We're going to spend a lot of time on step one, more than I normally do, because this is so essential that we know what we suffer from. So in step 8 and 9 and 10, he's now, once again, he had this beautiful step one experience. How many of us have tried to eat our way to a bottom? Anyone try to do that? Where am I going to hit my bottom? I'm just going to keep eating. I'm going to hit my bottom. He hits his bottom, but you'll see it says, trembling, I stepped from the hospital, a broken man, fear sobered me for a bit, and then the insidious insanity of that first drink. So if we don't have a solution, who cares how many bottoms we're hitting? Right? So he, in 8 to 12, he's starting to get this step two experience. His old friend Ebby comes. And this is where I think the choreography of God really comes in, because Ebby was brought this solution by Roland Hazard, who we're going to meet later, and I'm going to mess up the pronunciations, Harlan, but Cebu Graves and all these guys. I believe if Roland Hazard came to talk to Bill, we may not have a fellowship. If Cebu Graves came to talk to Bill, we may not have a fellowship. Because those guys didn't really understand the disease. So Bill, Ebby came to Bill with the solution. But the fact was that because Bill had the education on the disease, and he knew Ebby suffered what he suffered from. He knew him and Ebby were no different. In fact, I don't know if it's true, but what I have heard is that Ebby would say, if I ever get as bad as Bill, I'm going to stop drinking. And Bill would always say, if I ever get as bad as Ebby, I'm going to stop drinking. So he didn't have to say to Bill, listen, we both had the same thing. Bill knew it. So he was opened up to Bill. And I love how it says he was sober on page 9. It says, I wondered how he escaped. The door opened and he stood there, fresh-skinned and glowing. There was something about his eyes. He was inexplicably different. So I don't know if you've ever been at a meeting where someone sits next to you and goes, I've been abstinent for 10 years and 4 months and 6 days and 13 minutes! And you're like, oh my God! Because there's so much tension on them, because all they're doing is being abstinent, right? One day at a time, putting down the food, abstinence is the most important thing in my life, without exception, And then on the other side is someone saying, man, I've been abstinent for 6 months. I got to tell you about this amends. Oh my God, my first sponsee, I took my first fist up, and they are flying, and they're light, and they're airy. That's what I want. I want freedom. I don't want the bondage of abstinence. So that's what he's seeing. He's seen Ebby sober before. He's just never seen Ebby free. And that's what is exciting him. So it says here, he's starting to listen to him. He's aghast because he's telling him about this religious thing. And he's like, oh boy, here he goes. He says, but he did no ranting. In a matter-of-fact way, he told how 2 men had appeared in court, persuading the judge to suspend his commitment. They had told him of a simple religious idea and a practical program of action. That was 2 months ago. And the result was self-evident at work. 2 months. This is not about a step a year. This is not about having to be abstinent for 2 years before you do a 4 step. We're supposed to work this quickly because we're holding our breath underwater and we're going to eat again. And he's seeing that. It's self-evident. I mean, that's what I heard too. From, once again, 17 years in and out of relapse. And I had someone tell me I was recovered before I even realized it. She's like, Kim, there's something. I've known you for 20 years, Kim. Something's different. Something's going on here. So then let's go to the top of page 11 as he's being questioned about his old ideas. So the first thing it says to Christ. Now I'm going to use OA. To Overeaters Anonymous, I conceded the certainty of a great program, not too closely followed by those who claimed it. The moral teaching of the 12 steps was most excellent, but for myself, I had adopted those parts which seemed convenient and not too difficult, and I disregarded the rest. There's a really great AA speaker, Sandy B, who I love. And he says the longer that he's sober, the better his childhood gets. And that's what I find with OA. I used to be angry. Why didn't OA teach me about this big book? I didn't go to big book meetings. You know, why didn't OA do this? I actively avoided anyone that would confront me about my eating because I wanted to continue to eat. Or told me about, you know, there's a phrase in Vision for You, the chapter, that says, we create the fellowship we crave. I've always done that. If I was in relapse, I hung around people in relapse. If I was working a specific food plan, I only hung around people that ate that specific food plan. If I was only tool-based, I'd only hang around with people that tools. So the question I had to ask myself after 17 years is, what do I crave? And I craved freedom. And I started to gravitate towards those people that were showing freedom. And I am not saying that the Big Book is the only way to work the steps in Overeaters Anonymous. I'm just telling you it was the path that took me to a freedom that I wasn't able to get anywhere else. But once again, because I was working Kimberly Greik Anonymous, I wasn't really working Overeaters Anonymous. I feel like I worked a program of slogans and people's opinions. And that got me relapse after relapse after relapse. So I had to ask myself, is it that OA doesn't work, or is it I'm not working it? I mean, I think to myself, it works if you work it, right? I didn't know what it was for over a decade and a half. What the hell is it? Meeting makers make it? I made a lot of meetings. And what I found for myself is this, in my area, do you guys have relapse and recovery meetings? Do you ever have that concept? It's big in Region 7. But what I realized is I used to say that I'm a relapse survivor. But if recovery is the 12 steps, right? Page 59, it says, here are the steps we took but are suggested as a program of recovery. If I'm not working the 12 steps, basically I'm not relapse and recovering, I'm going on and off a diet. And the fellowship is strong. So the fellowship could keep me abstinent for certain periods of time. But if it's a bunch of human beings, and I would go past. So what I was realizing is I wasn't relapsing and recovering. What was happening is the disease was progressing, and I was able to stay abstinent for less and less periods of time as my disease progressed. So if we go to page 13 now, because Bill's being confronted by this step two question. And it says at the top of page 13, at the hospital, I was separated from alcohol for the last time. Treatment was wise, for I showed signs of delirium tremens. This was so essential. The food has to be down. We're going to talk about the doctor's opinion tomorrow. But the simplest way that I think about it is there's a line in the doctor's opinion that says that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. I cannot get the effect from the steps if I'm still getting the effect from the food. So I had to understand that. And I wasn't, once again, I don't know how much I was told it was okay to eat while I was doing the steps, or how much that's what I heard because I wanted to hear it. Because I don't know about you guys, but if I want to break up with a guy, or I want to stay with a guy and he's bad news, I'll ask 100 people and I'll keep asking until I hear the answer I want to hear. So 9 of them will tell me break up with the guy, and then one guy says don't break up with him. I'm like, oh, okay, I believe you. So that, I think that's what I did in OA too. I kept asking questions until I got people that agreed with my bullshit. So the food has to be down in order for me to do the work. I personally am very, very grateful for the women and men in this program that were more concerned about saving my life than hurting my feelings. I needed to hear that truth, as painful as that was. And then you're going to see on page 13 and 14, he simply goes through the steps really, really quickly. Because now that he knows that he's screwed, step one, and he knows that he needs a power, step two, and you're propelled to a decision to finish the work becomes quicker. Because I have an urgency now to get through this work because I know I'm going to eat again. We're going to talk about this tomorrow, but a big thing for me is I thought step one meant don't eat no matter what, no matter what, don't eat. But what this big book taught me was I'm going to eat, I'm going to eat, I'm going to eat unless I have a spiritual awakening. So on page 13, on page 14 at the top, it says simple but not easy. A price had to be paid. Now, how many of you have heard simple but not easy? It's amazing how we take things out of context, right? The whole entire sentence is simple but not easy. A price has to be paid. What is that price? It meant the destruction of self-centeredness. We learn in step three that I'm selfish and self-centered. I'm driven by 100 forms of fear. How do I destroy that? I destroy that by going through the rest of the steps. The big book process specifically, and the steps specifically, are not about addition, it's about subtraction. I get rid of my fears, I get rid of my resentments, I get rid of my selfishness. Society tells us, no, if you're feeling bad, have more food, have more sex, have more stuff, have more money. If that was true, then we'd have no, well, you guys are in LA, you would have no celebrities with addictions, right? If that was really true, you guys have all the success in the world here. And I don't know, I was kind of hoping to run into some celebrities in a 12-step meeting. I'm going to an AA meeting or something. So I like that the Serenity Prayer, which I said over and over again, I thought that was the program. If I say the Serenity Prayer, I won't eat. But I like when someone put it in context. In the last couple of years, I heard someone speaking about it. They said, God grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change, steps 1, 2, and 3. The courage to change the things I can, steps 4 through 9. And the wisdom to know the difference, which is steps 10, 11, and 12. So number one, that tells me I don't know the difference between self-will and God's will until I get to 10, 11, and 12. That's why I need the fellowship to support me. The fellowship will support me, and the steps will change me. So I need that combination right there. So let's drop down to that last paragraph on 14 into 15. My friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all of my affairs. Particularly, it was imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead, he said, and how appallingly true for the alcoholic. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again, and if he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that. So I often hear there's no must in the program, and you know everything's a suggestion. And it's absolutely true that the 12 steps are suggested. You can sit in the rooms of Overeaters Anonymous for decades and not work a step. If that is your right. But if you want to have freedom, if you want to have a spiritual awakening, there's going to be a lot of musts, a lot of always, a lot of nevers. And there's going to be an absolute necessity to do this work. It is imperative to work with others. I honestly thought working with others was optional. I thought that was for like the people in intergroup. Like they were the sponsors and us people in the meetings didn't have to do that stuff. And I have to tell you that I believe the biggest difference for me when I recovered 9 years ago from when I recovered, when I was dabbling in OA, is that I work with people on a consistent basis. My step 12 keeps me in touch with my step 1 because I'm helping people with their step 1. Because I get to see what it's like when people aren't doing the work. And I get to rework the steps every single time I bring someone through that. Going through the book as a sponsee is really wonderful. But I didn't learn the book until I started teaching the book. And then it says, for if an alcoholic failed to enlarge his spiritual life. So that's what we're trying to do, right? And there's a bunch of different ways to enlarge your spiritual life. There's a lot of spiritual practices, books and religions and things like that. But what does it mean to enlarge your spiritual life in a 12-step program? It says through work, which is 10 and 11. And what is 10 and 11? It's 4 through 9. So we can't do 10 and 11 until we've done 4 through 9. So the work is 10 and 11 and self-sacrifice for others, which is step 12. So the way we enlarge our spiritual life in a 12-step program is by practicing those 12 steps. I'll probably be repeating this again, but I always love when I heard this on a talk. The guy said, in religion, they say, here are the principles. Do them. In AA, they say, here are the principles. You don't have the power to do them. So the problem is that I am blocked from power. 1 through 9 unblocks me from that power. And in 10, 11, I get access to that power. And that's where my spiritual work is able to grow. And it says, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots. Life is not going to discontinue just because I did the steps. I always thought, well, if I do these steps, that means, you know, God will solve all my problems. That means I'm going to get my way. It doesn't mean I'm going to get my way. But what it means, I have connection to a power now that when life comes up, I'm not going to be pummeled by them. You know, I was thinking today, because I'm from the East Coast, and I assume it's the same with the Pacific Ocean as it is with the Atlantic Ocean. But if you want to know what powerlessness is, go to the ocean, put your hand out, and try to stop a wave. That'll tell you what powerless is. But with God, we can be a beautiful part of the ocean, or with these principles. So we're coming up on 4 o'clock. So I just wanted to give you guys a kind of idea of what this weekend is going to look like, since this workshop will be going through the whole entire weekend, because I know there's a lot of stuff, you guys, a lot of options. So I just wanted to kind of let you know. Okay. So tomorrow morning, we're going to spend the whole morning on step one. So the way that I do this is I talk for, with a three-hour period, I'll probably talk for about 50 minutes. Then we're going to take a 10-minute break, talk for 50 minutes, take a 10-minute break. So we'll keep starting at the top of the hour, but there'll be a 10-minute break beforehand to kind of let you stretch your legs and everything like that. So tomorrow morning, we're going to do the doctor's opinion at 9. We're going to do there's a solution at 10. And 11, we're going to do more about alcoholism. And then I will not let you out late, because I never let anyone out for OA late for lunch, because you guys will kill. I go to AA functions, and I'm not an alcoholic, but I go to AA functions. They seem to think lunch is very fluid. I'm like, what? When are you guys breaking? And then the afternoon is 2 to 5, so we're going to do step 2 at 2 o'clock, step 3, I didn't even know that, step 3 at 3 o'clock. And then at 4 o'clock, just like Bill's story, we're going to go through 4 through 9 in about an hour. So what I want to do is just give you a general overview of what the 4 through 9 looks like according to the big book. So hopefully you'll get excited and want to do it when you leave here. And then Sunday morning, it's 9 a.m. to 10:45, and we're going to do steps 10, 11, and 12. And I wanted to give you guys the option. I do want to give you the option for, like, asking questions. But I know personally I don't like to ask questions out loud. So if anyone wants to just write down their questions on a piece of paper and give it to me, you can do that as well. And we'll start at the top of the hour for any questions that people have about what we went over, because I want to give you that opportunity for that time. And we have about 20 minutes left. So I actually wanted to see if anybody had any questions they want to do for the last 20 minutes about the format or about questions in general. Okay, the question was how I work other 12-step programs. I am only in OA. When I recovered 9 years ago, though, the meetings in my area were not big book focused. There was a lot of relapse. And I actually attend AA meetings, but I'm not a member of AA. I'm not an alcoholic. And I'll actually talk about that tomorrow, because I'm a hard drinker. If I told you about my 20s, you probably would think I was an alcoholic, but I'm not. So I only am in Overeaters Anonymous as a member, but I will attend other 12-step fellowships because I love the speakers. Yeah. Back there? Okay, so the question was about the time frame for working with sponsees. You know what I love is that each of us are going to have the instructions are clear, but we all have different personalities, so we're going to take people through differently. I take people through in about 2 or 3 months. I talk to people on the phone usually 3 days a week for about a half hour. That seems to be my comfort level. Some people will tell me that's way too slow, and other people tell me it's way too fast. So what I believe is in the choreography of God, that you're going to be brought to someone that'll you guys can work together. But I basically have a conversation in the beginning with them because I want to know their history. Like, are they brand new to OA? Have they been in OA for decades? Are they coming from obesity, bulimia, anorexia? Are they coming from another 12-step program? You know, are they coming from a religious background or atheistic background? So I can kind of see how to approach them. And then I always start out with the doctor's opinion. Because, you know, when you come into AA, when they say get sober, it's pretty clear what that means. But in OA, we're an umbrella fellowship. So we all have the same definition of abstinence, everyone in this room, right? We all have to put down those foods, those ingredients, and those behaviors that create the phenomenon of craving. However, what creates the phenomenon of craving in me may not create the phenomenon of craving in you. But so the first thing I want to do is, and I kind of assume that I'm having that conversation that we just talked about with Bill and Ebby, Bill was drinking when he was talking to Ebby, so I kind of assume someone's not abstinent when we're going through the doctor's opinion, whether they're actively knowing they're eating or maybe they don't even know their own abstinence and they think that they're abstinent and they're not, so that we can identify what all those foods are. And then once we go through that, I say, are you willing to put all these foods, those ingredients, and these behaviors that we identified down? And as long as they say yes, I say, okay, let's go. And usually the next appointment is a day or two later, so they have 24 to 48 hours, and then we just keep moving through. So I start out with that doctor's opinion and move right through the chapters to working with others, which is the chapter about sponsoring. I personally do not cover the chapters to the wives, the employer, family afterwards, and vision for you. I just cover up through working with others. Anyone else? Oh. I tell them I won't work with them, to be honest with you, because I tell them that I don't want to give them the false impression that the steps will work if you're still eating. Because then you're going to get this impression that, like, the steps don't work. And the steps work if we're abstinent. So I tell them if and when they're willing to put the food down to give me a call back. One of my favorites, well, this was many, many years ago. I took someone through the doctor's opinion in January. And we identified her binge foods and her ingredients. And I said, okay, are you willing to put them all down? And it was like crickets. And then she said, maybe I'll call you back after Girl Scout cookie season's over. And I thought, man, I get that. It's only a limited period of time. I wouldn't. I understand you. So no, I will not continue with them. Doesn't mean I wouldn't be supportive of them if they want to talk to me, if they have any questions. But as far as taking them through the steps, until the person's willing to put the food down, there's nothing I can do to help them.
Did the person ever call you back after she got rid of the Girl Scout?
No. I have to tell you, it's funny. One of my AA mentors in Philadelphia, I was in an AA meeting, and this one guy was complaining because he's trying to work with all these guys, and none of them are getting through the steps, and he's really frustrated and everything. And he said, listen, he goes, I kind of consider this like baseball. He said, you know, and you can be in the Hall of Fame of baseball if you hit the ball one out of four times. You know, if you're 333, he goes, I figure if I can get 2 out of 10 guys through the steps, I'm in the AA Hall of Fame. So, you know, I've worked with hundreds of people. I'm probably exaggerating, but a lot of people, and a small percentage of them are still abstinent today. But I have to tell you, I've been 100% successful because I've been abstinent the whole time. So I am grateful for every person that lets me work with them, but it doesn't mean my job is to carry the message. That's why I love the 12th step. We try to carry this message. It doesn't say we successfully do it. But I try to carry this message, and what I absolutely love is when I work with someone and they fail or they fall, and I, you know, I worry about them and everything, and then I hear them see them at a meeting, or I hear them on the phone line, and they work the steps with someone else and they're recovered, because it's my arrogance to think that I'm the only person that can help them. You know, I only can present the steps in the way that I do it, and then maybe they need to hear it in a different voice in a different way. And I don't want to stop them from finding that other person by just, you know, selfishly saying, oh, keep working with me. Anyone else? I think formats are really important, personally. Like that, when we changed our format to a page-by-page big book study, there was a big change in growth because there was now a focus. And part of the format says that that we share on what was read, and we do not do any personal sharing from outside the paragraph. I forget how we word it. And in the beginning, it was very difficult because that's not the way we share in South Jersey. It's always about your husband and your kid and whatever. But what we found is the more that we kept the format focused on step work and on stuff that we were reading, the more the meeting grew. What we started doing was when people started to really get very curious is we started to hang out afterwards to help them
with the doctor's opinion, and it actually grew into the point now my home group has a step one meeting after our meeting every week, and that's been really fabulous, not just to find a sponsor, but the people who were newly recovered looking for sponsees. It's a great place for them to go to try to find people to work with. So a lot had to do with we were looking at formats. We took a format from a Philadelphia AA group. I can't remember, but I forget. There's a line, I love it, but I can't think of it right now. But that was a big thing, and this is an intergroup thing, too. When I was intergroup chair, one of the things we used to do is, in my area, you don't start a meeting because you want to share the message. You share the meeting because there's too much traffic and you don't want to drive too far. Like, that's why we start meetings. So I've always suggested that try to get a group of 4 or 5 people that are committed to this meeting and do it for 6 months to even see if it's viable before you put it on World Service website, because otherwise that meeting's going to be floating around and people are going to be going to a closed meeting. So my suggestion more is if you like this big book path, is start working with people, help them recover, get a cluster of people together. And either my home group hasn't changed, so it wasn't like we started a meeting. We just changed the format of our meeting. But make a commitment that you're going to work these steps in this specific way and see if it attracts people. See if you get people who are interested in that, and then and try to get your format to a place where it really focuses on working the steps. I'm just going to say this because, and this is not, since we're talking about the OA birthday too, this is some conjecture on my part too. When I hear AA history, so AA started in 1934. The second edition of the Big Book came out in the early 50s, and they talk about a 75 to 90% recovery rate. I mean, it's huge, especially in Cleveland area. And it was the book over your Alcoholics Anonymous and the Fellowship Alcoholics Anonymous, there wasn't much of a difference. It was all about the big book and the steps. In the 1960s, when rehab started opening up and they got a big influx of people coming into the meetings, people were trying to create the therapy rehab feeling that they got in these rehabs in the meetings. And that's when they started starting open discussion meetings and topic meetings, and they got away from working the steps. And AA saw its numbers just plummet with recovery. So here's where my conjecture comes in. When did OA start? 1960. So OA was growing just as AA was starting to have dips in their meetings because they were based on open discussion meetings. What I personally feel is we started to mimic AA the fellowship instead of AA the step work. So a lot of our meetings at that time were very based on sharing and, you know, don't you share it or wear it, or, you know, your feelings and all this kind of stuff. So we were just mimicking what was there. Our books all say the word recovering. This big book says the word recovered. What were they saying in the rehabs in the 60s and 70s? Recovering. That's when that language leaked into AA. When were we growing? In the 60s and 70s. So I kind of feel like we were almost mimicking what AA was doing, as opposed to really going back, which is why I love this big book, because this big book is when AA was growth was at its height. And I believe if we start focusing on the step work in OA, we can have that same growth potential that AA had in the 30s and the 40s. Does that make sense? Okay, this is going to be very controversial. Now, I'm going to read something too. Oh, I'm sorry. The question was, what do I do once I get someone through the 12 steps? So in the first, I don't know if this book has it. This book should have it. Yeah, Dr. Bob's Nightmare. I'm going to read the introduction to Dr. Bob's Nightmare. It says, the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, the birth of our society, dates from his first day of permanent sobriety, June 10th, 1935. To 1950, the year of his death, he carried the AA message to more than 5,000 alcoholic men and women. And to all these, he gave his medical services without thought of charge. So he was sober for 15 years and helped 5,000 men. That's 333 people a year. I don't think he was talking to them every single day, and I don't think he was talking to them for the rest of their lives. He helped them get a connection with God and told them, go help other people. And we're going to see in this big book over and over again, it says, when you are shaky, go help another alcoholic. So it's very, and once again, this is just my opinion, but I think this is also a Mars and Venus thing, that OA is so dominant by women. I don't know about you, but my brother, if he talks to his best friend every other month or best friends, if I don't hear from a girlfriend after a week, I think she's mad at me. So I think as women, we just like to talk a lot more. So we're really into that talking every day and talking for the rest of our lives. So when I get someone through the steps, I feel that my job is to help the next suffering compulsive overeater. Their job is to help the next suffering compulsive overeater. And they're going to get more from helping someone else than just talking to me. It doesn't mean that I'm not available if they have questions. And, you know, nowadays with texting and everything, I mean, just text me and we'll make sure we'll talk in a day or two. But their recovery is going to be on carrying the message. And I have to tell you, just for me personally, that doing it this way creates an urgency for sponsoring. Because if they know they can continue to talk to me, why would they even get a sponsee? No need to. They can just continue to talk to me all the time. Now, I want to say that that's not how everyone does it. And I support whatever gives you freedom. So if you get freedom talking to a sponsor every day, if you get freedom with a lifelong relationship with a sponsor, rock on. So I'm just going to be sharing my own experience. I'm going to be sharing what the directions in the big book says. But if what you're doing isn't working, then maybe you might want to consider trying it a different way. You know, and once again, selfishly, I'm going to say this, but the recovery rate in OA is very, very low. We need more people out on the firing lines helping others than talking to each other and and just hanging out with girlfriends. You know, I have said this too. I mean, I love Vision for You. I really do. But people listen to that meeting 3-4 hours a day. I wish they would listen half that time and spend that other time working with other people. I personally go to my home group. I don't go to a lot of meetings because I'm on the phone every night working with people. I feel I have my home group where I do my fishing. I find people to work with. And the other nights, I'm working with people because that's where I get my blood in there. I know that's controversial. And if anyone wants to talk to me about it, that's fine. But like I said, to me, I am so results-driven. So if you're getting results the way you're doing it, please don't change anything. But if anything's resonating, especially if it's ticking you off, you might want to have a conversation. Because if you're totally okay with what you said, usually something doesn't tick. At least for me, if I'm okay with what I'm doing, nothing ticks me off. If something ticks me off, it's usually a little tap from God. There's something you got to think about with that, Kim. You had your hand up. I do not have a sponsor. What I call them are mentors. They're people who are further down the path that I utilize for my questions, my 10 steps, and advice. I have about 5 of them. Once again, just my opinion, but I've seen so many people panic because they have a sponsor and that sponsor picks up and they have no idea what to do because their sponsor was their God. A lot of my mentors from 9 years ago aren't even abstinent. So I have mentors in my life that are further along the path that I depend on, but I don't depend on any one person. And the reason I like that word is because in the big book, they use the word protege for new people. And the opposite of a protege is a mentor. So I like to use that terminology. These are my mentors. And I have mentors in AA, even though I'm not an alcoholic, because they are truly my teachers in many ways. We have about 7 minutes. Anybody want to? Back there?
Yeah.
Well, I have to tell you, I'm the kind of person that give me the degree and maybe I'll take some classes. Like, I want the results before I do the work, which is kind of what I'm hearing. I want to be able to plug into God, even though I haven't done the work yet to plug into God. So what I often tell people in step one is you can't pause and connect into. If you could pause and connect into a power, then we wouldn't need 12 steps, right? We could have a pamphlet that says, admit you're powerless, plug into God. Goodbye. Like that. That's all we need. So what I often tell people, if you're in step one, what you want to do is create a pause. So if you're in step one, pause with the doctor's opinion. Pause. There's four great stories and more about alcoholism. There's a man of 30, Jay Walker, Jim, Fred. Pause. Think about Jim. Where do you identify in with Jim? Where do you identify in with Fred? And utilize your fellowship. I mean, my personal opinion, again, is, you know, I disrespected a 12-step program by working an 8-tool program. I think it's very easy to work the tools and not work the steps. I think it's impossible to work the steps and not work the tools. But the question is, what is your purpose? So if you are in step one and you want to have that connection with God, are you going to meetings that are based on the solution? Are you calling people that have the solution that you want? Are you taking time with literature that's going to help you where you're at in your steps? So I just tell people, yes, you take that quiet time, but take the quiet time where you're at, not where you want to be. Because you need to create that space for step one, step two, step three, step four, step five. And what I find, why that helped me was because I felt like a frickin' loser. Because you're telling me to do 10 and 11. You're telling me I should feel a connection with this power. And I don't feel anything because I'm still detoxing. And I thought I'm doing it wrong. Why is everyone else able to do something I can't do? When I realized I shouldn't be able to connect with a power at step 10. I shouldn't be able to connect a power with step 11 because I haven't gotten to that point yet. So I think it's good as sponsors too to create disciplines for your sponsees to help them create that space by helping them get in the literature. I mean, one of the first things I do with my sponsees is I have a list in my phone of all the people I've worked with who are recovered, and I send that phone list off to them to give them a starting point. If you're talking to somebody and you really are connecting with them, ask them who their mentors are. Ask them who they sponsor. Because if you are liking the language they're using, then odds are the people they're talking to speak that same language, and you can start to create that fellowship you crave. I always talk about this, like the fellowship I need is I need to have people ahead of me by putting my hand out to those further along the path. I need to have my hand behind me helping those people that are below, you know, further behind me on the path. And I need to have people walking shoulder to shoulder with me who are on this path. And if I do those things, then I have a fellowship around me that's going to support me. So I ask people to do that starting from step one is start to think, what do you crave? How can you do that? Go to meetings that are solution-based. Call people that are solution-based. Look at literature that's solution-based. Ask questions. Talk about step one when you're in step one. Talk about step two when you're in step two. Talk about step three when you're in step three. Embrace that step. Bathe yourself in the big book is the way I like to put it, or whatever literature you're working in. All right, so anybody got a burning desire? We got 2 minutes till this session is over.
Can you say a little bit about your abstinence? I mean, your food plan.
Thank you for asking that. Yeah, thank you for asking that because I'm not going to answer that question. My food plan is irrelevant. Because my food plan is for a 52-year-old woman who's postmenopausal and does yoga and walks my dog. It probably isn't relevant to you. So we're going to talk about that tomorrow because abstinence is refraining from those foods that cause the phenomenon of craving. The food plan is the limit and boundaries around the foods that I can eat, and that should come from a professional. And that's I am an expert at being a compulsive overeater, and I can help you develop what your abstinence is. I have no idea what you should eat. No clue. I like the sign for no clue. I like that. I'm gonna use that. Okay, well, first of all, thanks everyone for coming. I really appreciate it. I hope I see you later on. And thank you.